I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The Sunday Review of the New York Times on September 14 had a front page article that caught our attention titled Beyond Marriage, an Opinion Piece, and it's from Isabel Sawhill. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. Marriage is disappearing. More than 40% of new mothers are unmarried, and she writes in the piece, many young adults drift into parenthood unintentionally. If we could combine an updated social norm with greater reliance on the most effective forms of birth control, we can transform drifters into planners and improve children's life prospects. We're delighted to have her with us this hour of the program, and she has a really impressive resume. She was the Associate Director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration and a member of the President's Welfare Reform Task Force. You'll recall that debate, efforts to make welfare conditional on work, which did pass. She was a supporter of that and hoped that it would make women think twice before having a child on their own. But she writes this piece, the growth of births outside marriage has continued almost unabated. She helped to found the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy and now serves as the president of its board. She's been a visiting professor at Georgetown Law School, director of the National Commission for Employment Policy, and president of the Association for Public Policy Analysis and Management. She serves on a number of boards, and she attended Wellesley and received her PhD from NYU in 1968. Welcoming phone calls for her. We've already had a lot of response on our Facebook page on this issue, and I think we'll have quite a bit on air as well. For you to join this conversation, the phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. So that's how you reach us. Isabel, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
And thank you for writing the article. It was just, you know, I read the article, I went, oh my goodness, oh my goodness, oh my goodness. It was just a really thought-provoking article.
Well, I hope it will start a new debate and discussion about these issues, because I think they're very important and they haven't gotten quite as much attention as I would like.
Well, you're absolutely right, and you're giving it attention. I guess I didn't realize, Isabel, that 40% of new mothers are unmarried. That is really amazing to me.
Well, it is surprising, especially for someone who grew up in an earlier era when marriage was the standard way of raising children. And by the way, for women under the age of 30, that proportion is 50% are having their children outside of marriage.
Wow. It is not exactly the same for those who have college degrees, I understand. Is that right?
That's exactly right. There is a very big divide by educational group. I call it the new class divide in American society, and it is adding to income inequality, to inequalities in education, to create bigger differences between groups in the United States, with people at the top increasingly doing well on all these dimensions and people at the bottom not doing well. Amongst the best educated, those with a BA degree, we don't see much childbearing outside of marriage. They are still getting married and then having children after they marry.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not true for the rest of America. And the rest of America is about two-thirds of America. In other words, only about one-third of America has a BA degree. The other two-thirds are seeing much higher rates of unwed childbearing.
Mm-hmm. You write in the piece about what liberals argue as a response to this and what conservatives argue. Let's start with conservatives, because we'll get into another whole issue discussion in a moment. The problem, conservatives, many would say, is cultural, that what we need to do is restore marriage, which maybe everybody, a lot of people would agree on that. And yet that just hasn't happened for whatever reason. Why hasn't that happened? Why don't people want to get married?
Well, it's a big mystery to some extent. I can speculate about the reasons and say a bit about what the literature research shows on this. I think probably the primary reason that people aren't getting married anymore is because social norms around marriage have changed dramatically. It's no longer considered inappropriate to have a child outside of marriage. It is no longer considered inappropriate to have premarital sex. There's no stigma attached, or very little anyway, to being a single parent. So people have a lot more choices than they used to, and they are taking advantage of those choices to form lots of different types of families and have children in lots of different kinds of circumstances.
And yet, and you've done a great deal of work in this area, we look at the teen pregnancy rate in this country, and it's going down. Pregnancy now, the age limit is just going up a little bit. It's 20-somethings, right?
Well, that's right. The good news here is that teen pregnancy and birth rates have declined really quite dramatically since about the early 1990s. But what we're seeing is this problem of unwed childbearing moving up the age scale. So now it's women in their 20s, or I should say men and women, because of course it takes two, who are having very high rates of unwed childbearing. And they're not marrying, as we just discussed, and so they're having children outside of marriage, and the rate is quite high.
And when you look at the consequences of that, I've worked with some young women who just think it's wonderful to have a child who will adore them, and you look at the reality soon after the child is born, and oh my gosh, what a huge thing it is to raise a child and work and support yourself and support a child and pay for rent and get child care. It's just enormous, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I look at single mothers or single parents, for that matter. We have an increasing number of dads in this situation as well, and I think, oh my gosh, how do they do it? They have to be heroically competent. And they have to be all things to their children. They have to earn all the money and do all the household chores and spend time with their kids. And I just think it's hard enough to be a parent when there are two of you and you have twice as much time and a lot more money because you can have two earners in the family. And but it's doesn't compare to being a single parent.
Well, a lot of the article deals with very effective means of birth control. Let me ask you, are we just seeing a lot of people not using birth control, or are there certain birth control methods being used that aren't very reliable?
It's some of both. About half of the people who are sexually active are not using birth control, even though most of them don't really want to get pregnant. And the other half are using it, but often using it very inconsistently. I think we forget that it's hard to use birth control very consistently. If you think about the two most common methods, especially amongst young adults, they're condoms and the pill. And with a condom, you know, you have to remember to use it in the heat of the moment, which is pretty difficult, and you have to use it appropriately. And with the pill, a lot of people forget to take a pill, or they forget to get their prescription refilled, or don't get around to it. So, you know, we all make mistakes, and it's real easy to not be a consistent user of birth control.
And yet there are other long-term methods of birth control which may have a significant impact on all that we've been talking about.
Yes, I'm very encouraged about the potential of newer methods to change the picture here. We call them long-acting reversible contraceptives, or LARCs for short. That's the acronym for long-acting. And it includes implants, and it includes IUDs. We have very little use of those methods in the United States right now. Some other countries use them far more than we do, and they are far more effective than other kinds of birth control because they don't put any burden on the user. You know, once you've got the IUD inserted, you don't have to do anything, and you're not going to get pregnant. You're going to be fully protected. And this really changes the default from getting pregnant if you do nothing, for example, don't use a condom, to not getting pregnant if you do nothing, such as don't go get your IUD taken out.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that we're not going that route is because, what, it's more expensive? People don't know how to insert these devices, or what?
It's a combination of all of that. It is very expensive. It can cost as much as $1,000 to get an IUD, and, of course, many women cannot afford that. It's less expensive over the course of your reproductive life than say, the pill. But those upfront costs loom large. Now, the Affordable Care Act has the potential to cover all forms of contraception, including IUDs and implants, but it's too new to know just how that's going to work. On the provider side, quite apart from the cost, there are many doctors and other healthcare providers that just aren't terribly familiar about these newer forms and aren't well trained in them and therefore don't offer them to their patients.
Mm-hmm. You cited in the New York Times piece a Washington University study of 10,000 demographically representative women in the St. Louis region. Can you tell me what the findings were? They're rather striking.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I want to add one thing that I think is quite important on your last question, and that is a lot of people don't use these long-acting forms of contraception because they think they're unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
There was some problem in the past with them. You may remember the whole Dalkon Shield event. But according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, they are safe now. And people need to know that because there are a lot of myths out there about it.
Mm-hmm.
Turning to the study in St. Louis, it was a wonderful study. They basically offered this expensive form of contraception to all of the women coming into their clinic. And so it was a broadly representative group of women, slightly tilted towards more disadvantaged women. And they gave them counseling, and they explained how effective these LARCs were and that they were safe and hassle-free. And so there was a very high take-up rate of LARCs as compared to other forms of contraception because these women were offered all the types. And they found that at the end of, say, 3 years, the proportion of people who'd gotten pregnant, even though they were trying not to, was 20% higher for those on the pill than those on a LARC.
Hmm. Fascinating.
And 20 times as high. Did I say it right? 20 times 20 as high.
Okay.
On the pill as opposed to on a LARC.
Uh-huh. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. We're looking at why it is so many women are having babies without being married and whether or not a cultural change and a promotion of marriage, I don't quite know how you do that, but if that would change things or if we need to look at what she just talked about, which is a big part of her New York Times piece, long acting birth control measures that may indeed keep 20-somethings because teen pregnancy has gone down from unplanned pregnancies. You know, it's a huge thing. I just, maybe I'm just old-fashioned here. I'm old, but It's really quite a change, at least in my lifetime. There used to be a cultural taboo about being pregnant and not being married, and maybe that was too strong a taboo. But you could say that there is something to be said for two incomes, two people helping to raise a child, to have a role models, you know, be they female and male or males or females, but have two people involved in this really difficult process of raising a child. What do you think? There go the phones. I knew they would. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Isabel Sawhill is our guest. She's a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. She serves as co-director of the Budgeting for National Priorities Project and co-director of the Center on Children and Families. She helped to found the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy and is now a president on the board. And she also was in the Clinton administration, where she was Associate Director of the Office of Management and Budget and a member of the President's Welfare Reform Task Force. What do you think of these numbers? Does it bother you? What about the resulting poverty? How do we change this? We welcome your phone calls and we'll take them in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have many phone calls coming in for our guest, Isabel Sawhill, and so let's start, huh? Ryan in Menominee, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Hey, this is a topic that kind of hits close to home here. My wife and I have been married for 5 years, have two wonderful children, and 5 years ago, we'd been together to the point where most people will be getting married, and we'd spoken about it, and her belief was the marriage is just a piece of paper, that we didn't need to be married to be together, and we didn't need to be married to love each other. And I was always raised, same as you, I was always raised that marriage was an institution and it was important. But the more time went on, the more I began to agree with her. The only reason we'd gotten married in the first place was so she could come overseas with me when I was stationed in Germany. And as trivial of a reason as that seems to be to get married, that's the only reason that we got that piece of paper that says we're married. I firmly believe that if we hadn't gotten married, we'd still be together and we'd still have our children, and it wouldn't make that big of a difference. It wouldn't be that big of a deal.
Isabel.
Oh, that is a great question and a great story, and I've thought about it a lot. Certainly the piece of paper doesn't make the difference. What makes the difference is the level of commitment that people have to each other, and it sounds like you guys have a lot of commitment to each other. But looking at the broader statistics, what we see is a big increase in cohabitation, living together without being married and having kids. But by the time the child is age 5, about half of those arrangements have split up. And that's very different from marriage for a variety of reasons. Married people don't split up nearly as often as those who cohabit. And some people have said, well, that's probably because people who marry have other characteristics that are different than those who just live together. And there have been attempts to look at that and adjust for that. And it still looks as if marriage is a bit more stable, but you're right, it shouldn't make a huge difference. And in Europe, they seem to have adopted a lot of arrangements that involve just living together and raising children together. And it looks more like a stable marriage than it does so far in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for calling. Janie in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
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 Enjoy your show always. I just have a couple little comments. I'm from the same era as you are, and I think that a lot of the younger people, I see them, kids with kids, I think there's too much social assistance, and when you start leaning on this type of help, how do you get out of it?
Well, I think there are a lot of people who have the same feeling, and I certainly encountered that when I was on the Welfare Reform Task Force in the Clinton administration. And so we took a look at the extent to which social assistance or welfare in different forms was causing people to have children on their own. And there isn't a lot of evidence that it causes them to have a child outside of marriage for that reason, but it may enable them to do so. I think that I am concerned that if the number of single parents continues to grow in the U.S., and we have something like half of all families being headed eventually by a single parent, it is going to be unaffordable. Right now, it's very hard, at least given the economy we have and are likely to have for decades to come, for just one person to support a family and have a middle-class lifestyle unless they're extremely well-educated and in a very high-paid job. Right now, it normally takes two incomes to support a family. And if you don't have two incomes and you don't have a fabulous job and a PhD and so forth, then you're probably going to be dependent on government. And we can't just keep going down that road. I don't think the American taxpayer would support it.
What do you think about marriage, Isabel? Do you think that the institution needs to be revived? Do you think it ever will be?
You know, I really don't know. I'm tending to be pessimistic right now because the trends have been so strongly in the opposite direction. In other words, people not marrying. But some people believe that because the very well-educated are still getting married, that eventually that will trickle down to the rest of society. I'm not sure. I would like to see marriage come back. I think that it is a very good environment for raising kids, and the degree of commitment that it symbolizes is important. But I'm just not terribly optimistic right now.
Okay.
Well, we've tried various policies to bring back marriage. During the Bush administration, we had a lot of so-called marriage education programs, and they've been carefully evaluated. They didn't seem to move the needle very much.
Thank you, Janie, for your call. Steve in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I wanted to follow up on a point that was discussed before the break, and it was about the cultural evolution needed to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And we talked about, or you talked about the implants, the LARCs. I wanted to also hear your views on the political ramifications of that, because as I recall, they tried to do something about helping to prevent unwanted pregnancies in Obamacare, and the right-wing political machine blew up. And in China, where they tried to do something politically about controlling births, the whole world condemned them. Yet we have this huge population explosion that we're in the middle of that's causing all kinds of problems. And we have, I think, a real interest as a society in helping to control unwanted pregnancies. I would even say taxpayers should help any woman get long-term birth control if that's what she wants, so that the burden doesn't fall on young girls that don't have a lot of money, and to prevent this problem. I think the society could contribute. But what do you think the politics of that are?
Well, I agree with the burden of your remarks very much. I think it is still a very toxic political subject in this country. We have had challenges to the Affordable Care Act and especially to the provision in the health care bill, the Obamacare bill, that says that women should have access to all forms of contraception with no copays. So that it wouldn't be costly to them. And that's being challenged in the courts as we speak. Some of this has already gone to the Supreme Court. You may know about the so-called Hobby Lobby decision.
Mm-hmm.
There are religious concerns about all of this. And I think at the same time, many of us would argue if a woman doesn't want to have a child and wants a effective way to prevent that, that should be her choice. And the public in the United States is overwhelmingly supportive of the idea of making birth control widely and inexpensively available to women who don't want a pregnancy. So we'll see how it plays out, but no question that the politics of it are not very good.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Steve, for your call. Let's go back a few years. I was interested that you wrote a book on the growth of single-parent families in the wake of the 1965 report by Daniel Patrick Moynihan, arguing that the breakdown of the black family, you write, was the cause of most social pathologies in inner-city communities, and now single parenthood is as common among whites as it was among blacks in the mid-60s. What did you write in that book, that early book?
Well, the trend was just beginning then, and it was at that time the trend towards more single parents. And at that time, it was driven primarily by an increased divorce rate. And the research that we did for that book, by the way, had a co-author by the name of Heather Ross, who I forgot to mention in my New York Times article, which is a source of some embarrassment. But anyway, what we said was, the research suggested that one of the reasons for the increase in the divorce rate was the fact that women now had an ability to support themselves. They could get jobs and reasonably good jobs, and they had more education than they had in the past. And men were not adjusting as quickly as they might have to these new opportunities, and so women were doing what are sometimes called two shifts, you know, holding a job
right.
and still having all the responsibility for household tasks and childcare. And this led to tensions within the family and was one factor, not the only one, increasing the divorce rate. So that's one thing we said. On the black-white differences, We at the time thought that a lot of this was due to the poor economic prospects of black Americans, and I still think that's true to a large extent. But the rates of children born outside of marriage have continued to go up among both blacks and whites, and amongst blacks it's now 72%. So this is definitely the new norm in the black community, and I think although it may have had economic roots, in fact, Moynihan himself said it had its roots in high rates of joblessness amongst young black men, I think it's also begun to embed itself in the culture of that community now. It's just the way things are done.
Let's go to Edie in Hanover. Hi, Edie.
Hi. The guest had said a little while ago that that about 50% of non-married couples split up. And isn't it true that the divorce rate is at least 50%, if not greater, right now? And so that's not showing kids a sense of commitment or anything. To me, I just don't understand the whole point of legally getting married. I think we're at a point in our society that that we should be looking at how to best raise kids, sort of the concept of it takes a village to raise a child. That's my comment.
All right. Thanks, Edie.
On the statistics, you're right that the divorce rate measured in a particular way is around 50%. The way I was talking earlier about the split rate amongst unmarried couples being about 20%, that's in the first 5 years. If you looked at a similar split rate for married couples, I said it was 50% in the first 5 years. If you looked at the split rate for married couples in the first 5 years, it's much lower.
Oh.
So that gets into some, you know, apples and oranges type comparisons. You're right, but it's not a valid comparison. on why get married and whether it takes a village. I think to some extent it does take a village, but if the village is populated only by single parents, there are not enough other villagers to take care of all of them. Mm-hmm. So I think it's one thing to say we take care of people when they are having hard times and they're only, let's say, 10% of the population. And it's another thing to say that half the population can take care of the other half of the population on top of taking care of the elderly, which is a big fiscal burden for the country right now as well. So, you know, you have a shrinking group of people who are doing well and paying taxes to support both the elderly and this group of families who are increasingly needing help because there's only one parent.
Edie, thanks for the call. We have a lot of Facebook messages. Let me read several of them and choose to respond to what you'd like to respond to. James writes, I think more and more young people have come to the conclusion that marriage is irrelevant. I'm not sure whether that's a good thing or not. Greg writes, I believe people put too much of an emphasis on marriage. What's important is that parents are dedicated to one another and their children. If they can't be together, then the fact that they are respectful and compromising for their children is important. And Brandon writes, over 50% of traditional marriages end in divorce. They're a joke. What do you say, Isabel?
Well, I think that James is right that a lot of younger Americans think marriage is irrelevant, and that's why I'm not sure it's going to come back. And let me combine that with the next caller's comment, which is what really should matter is not whether you're married or not, but whether or not you are committed to your children and are a good parent. And in my book, I talk a lot about the fact that the old social norm was don't have a baby unless you're married. And I say the new social norm needs to be don't have a baby unless you're ready to be a parent and committed to doing what parenthood entails. Mm-hmm. And so I think I agree with both of them, and I think their comments are connected. I would add that I don't think marriage is totally irrelevant. I mean, I think it does symbolize a kind of commitment, and it does have a legal and institutional foundation in our culture and our society right now that we can't just dismiss entirely. The third caller was saying, what, that marriage is a joke because so many people get divorced?
Good for you. Good memory. Yes.
You know what's interesting about the divorce rate? It's coming down. Mm. It's been coming down ever since 1980. And the best way to look at it is not the way you read about it in the newspaper, which is typically of all married people, this many are getting divorced every year. Instead, it's to look at a particular set of marriages that have been entered into by a certain age group or a certain group of the population, and how many of them last how long. And if you look at the sort of longevity of marriage, amongst the youngest age groups, to the extent that we can measure it, marital longevity is going up. Hmm. People are divorcing less. And a lot of the reason is because they're getting married later. Mm-hmm. They tend to have more education. And because they have more education and they're getting married later, they're choosing more wisely who to marry. And those marriages are, not surprisingly, more stable than ones that are undertaken too early in life and before people have had the kind of experience with different relationships and with life itself to figure out what they really want in a long-term partner.
Right. Let's go to Kathy in Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. You know, I have seen in my own family that there doesn't seem to be the commitment to making a marriage last anymore, regardless. And generally, there have been children involved in the divorce, very young children involved, even when their parents divorced. There doesn't seem the commitment there anymore. But I'd also like to comment that all you have to do is go to the grocery store and you see the checkout line and you look at all the magazines, and it's essentially glorifying single parenthood. And a lot of this is, granted, they're celebrities, okay? These are people who can afford to do it. They can go to town. They can buy all the gewgaws and the designer baby clothes and the strollers and whatnot. But this is what gets publicized, and this is what the young people see and say, wow, this looks great, and it looks like a lark, and it isn't.
Isabel.
Well, I agree. The media in general glamorizes sex, glamorizes single parenthood, glamorizes all kinds of things that I think are not terribly good for you. You may recall that a long time ago, Vice President Dan Quayle gave a speech in which he criticized a television character named Murphy Brown.
Sure.
Because she had chosen to have a baby by herself, and he felt she was sending the wrong message to the younger generation, and I think he was right. Commitment does matter, and so the issue becomes, can we have the same kind of commitment without the piece of paper that we have with the piece of paper? But there's no question that it's not good for a child or children in general to have a lot of instability in their lives. They're very resilient, some of them more so than others, but they need a stable home environment and to flourish. So I think I kind of agree with you.
Thanks, Kathy. David in Ironwood, Michigan called and wonders if income inequality and jobs that don't pay very much affects a choice to marry.
Many people think it does. They especially point to the fact that at the bottom of the skill or education distribution, you know, people who are high school dropouts or have very little training beyond high school, that the men in particular in that category are finding it hard to find well-paying jobs. You know, the manufacturing jobs that used to support a middle-class lifestyle are gone. Most of the new jobs are either low-paid and in the service sector or high-paid and in the high-tech and financial services and other areas that you can't access unless you have a lot of education. And they say this lack of marriageable men at the bottom, by which they mean men who have decent-paying jobs, is causing the women in that same group to reject marriage as not in their best interest. They'd rather go it alone. That way, at least they have autonomy, and they don't feel like the men in their lives are adding enough value to make it worth marrying them. That's a lot of the what some of the more qualitative research is suggesting.
Well, that's pretty sad, isn't it?
You say it's sad?
Yeah, it is, really.
Yeah, it is sad, and certainly we should do something about improving the job prospects for those without very much education. I'm a big believer in first education, but secondly, some kind of job training. And we're not doing enough of it in this country. People are coming out of school without a specific skill that has a lot of value in the job market. And then, of course, this great recession we've been through and high rates of joblessness have not helped.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're responding to an article written by our guest in September 14, New York Times, looking at the number of new mothers. 40% of new mothers unmarried. If you're under 30, it's 50% of new mothers. And our guest has been thinking about this and writing about it for years. Do we need to restore marriage? Is that the answer? And if that's not going to happen, because trends would indicate that it's not, then what can we do to make sure that young people don't have children until they're ready to care for them? It's a really interesting piece, which we have on our Facebook page, too, in case you missed or didn't save the New York. Well, you can go online, too. I forgot. We're in a modern age. But we also have it on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll take more phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. Our lines have been busy. You can get through now. There are some lines open. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Our guest this hour is talking about marriage, Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, Co-Director of the Budgeting for National Priorities Project, Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families. She helped found the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy, is the president of the board right now. She has taught at Georgetown Law School. Director of the National Commission for Employment Policy, worked as Associate Director of the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration. All right, let's go to Myra next in Green Bay. Hi, Myra.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been listening to your show, and one thing that I haven't heard is a religious angle. I am a Christian, and I was married, and I guess I haven't heard anything about, you know, have you asked people for a side towards that? You know, is there a religious, do you think the reason for no commitment is people are pulling away from the church, the younger generation, therefore there is no commitment because of there's no religion? And also these people that are saying they don't need a piece of paper, if we don't need a piece of paper, why do we have the Constitution? Why do we have attorney agreements? That piece of paper is more binding, I think, than just a verbal agreement. So that's just my angle on it.
Thank you, Myra, for presenting your angle. Isabel.
Myra, I think that's a very thoughtful set of comments. And obviously, many religions, including the Christian religion, do sanctify marriage, do treat it as a special relationship, and I think that that matters to a lot of people, and that will help to keep marriage alive and well to the extent that people have religious faith. The younger generation does tend to be less religious than the older generation, so that may be playing a role. And I think that for many people, marriage is more than just a pragmatic way of raising children and living with another person. It does have religious significance for them.
Here's an email that's come in. Is marriage culture different with gay couples? Are we seeing any marriage trends in the gay community?
I'm surprised that question hasn't come up sooner, because when I talk about the fact that marriage is disappearing, there are two groups where it's not disappearing and where it, in fact, is, if anything, growing in popularity. And one group is gays and lesbians, and the other group that we talked about earlier is the very well-educated. Same-sex couples have not had the right to marry in the past, and even as we speak, they're only gaining that right in some states and not others. So this is all very new, and their enthusiasm for the institution is very interesting in light of what's happening in the rest of American society. I even talk in my book about how gay couples may be setting an example for other couples, because in a same-sex couple, there's no preordained division of labor between one partner and the other. They can organize things any way they want without past ideas about gender roles and so forth coming into play. And anyone who's interested can read what I say about that in the book, including try to review the research on those who have children and are in same-sex relationships to see if we know anything about that. And the short answer is we don't know a lot about it yet, but I don't see any problem at all with same-sex couples raising children. For one thing, those children will always be wanted and intended children by definition.
Yes, they will. Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage is the name of the book, right?
Right.
All right. I want to make sure we get that out there. Thanks, Myra, for your call. Zach in Madison. Hi.
Hi. I just had a quick comment. So one thing I actually haven't heard addressed that I'd love to hear the both of you discuss for a moment is just sort of the institution of marriage as it has been for many women as sort of actually a prison. You know, I'm thinking of a gender studies class I took a couple of years ago at the University of Arkansas where a statistic was cited that the most dangerous state of being for a person in terms of domestic violence in 2010 in Arkansas was to be a pregnant married woman at home in her kitchen. So if you could maybe, you know, speak to how all of this relates to women sort of escape from the institution as, you know, an oppressive factor and how that might play into their decision making. And I'll take my comment.
Thanks, Zach, for the call. Interesting.
You know, I'm not an expert on domestic violence, but I it certainly is an issue. And I do know that the research that has shown that the rising divorce rate has had some good consequences and some bad consequences. The bad consequences mainly being that it's not great for kids, but a good consequence has been not only to reduce domestic violence against married women, but also suicides amongst those women and murders of husbands by wives. And so if you're trapped in a very unhappy or abusive marriage and you can't escape, then all of those problems, domestic violence, suicide, murder, are all going to be greater. And there's research that shows that that's the case. Hmm.
Do you have recommendations for those families, single, usually mother families now, who aren't doing very well economically, recommendations of programs, because I know you were involved at this in the highest levels of the administration, to lift those children out of poverty? Do we know what's effective at this point in time or not?
Yes, I think we know quite a bit about that. And I have written not in so much in this book, but in other papers I've authored, including just this summer, on some very effective programs for moving children out of poverty. You go on my website at the Brookings Institution and put in Sawhill, you'll come across a paper called Improving Children's Life Chances that goes into detail. But briefly for now, we know that early childhood education is a terrifically good investment for young children growing up in low-income families. We know that for the adults involved, the earned income tax credit, which is a wage supplement that goes to workers in low-wage jobs, has done an excellent job of both encouraging employment and topping up the earnings of some of these single parents in low-wage jobs. The earned income tax credit can add as much as $5,000 to your paycheck. And if your paycheck is only, let's say, $10,000 a year, that's a big bump up. So, you know, I could go on about these kinds of programs. I think subsidized child care is very important. There aren't enough slots right now to serve everyone, but anyone who needs child care and can't afford it or wants higher quality child care should look into that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Isabel, you're so active on so many fronts. Good for you.
Oh, well, I'm old, so I've had a chance to learn a lot.
But you're still learning a lot, which is good. Thanks, Isabel, so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was very interesting. Isabel Sawhill, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, and she has done so much work in so many of these areas, children and marriage. And her latest book is Generation Unbound, Drifting into Sex and Parenthood Without Marriage. And she recommended because she has done so much writing. If you go to the Brookings Institution and then find Isabel Sawhill, you can find other papers that she's written about lifting children out of poverty. And I'm sure that there are references to the piece that she wrote back in 1968 concerning what Daniel Moynihan had to say about the black family. Well, that's it for this hour. Thanks so much to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to Scott Myers for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you tomorrow. Milwaukee Film Festival is starting soon, and we're going to speak with the authors of a documentary. One of the doctors who's done really amazing work on extending the human lifespan, one of our hours tomorrow, which should be interesting. Thank you very much for listening. News is coming up from NPR.